very few other organizations focusing on helping Black founders start businesses. So that's where we started in terms of the community work that we were doing. We have evolved. We are now focused on construction as far as the industry pillar. Healthcare is another one for us, and information technology. I would also say that we're currently looking at sustainability and climate change as another focus area, again, given, you know, you're constantly doing that search, that strategic search, where are the gaps in the marketplace, and that's where it's leading us to right now. I would also share that as we pivot away from startups, we are now fully focused on what we call mid-sized firms, helping firms to really grow and scale. They're generally over $2 million in annual revenues, have been in business about 3 to 5 years. Those are the businesses that we have decided to really focus our energy in helping them grow and scale. A lot of what is said in terms of entrepreneurship as the magic bullet in helping closing the racial wealth gap in this country using entrepreneurship doesn't focus on these mid-sized firms. And what we know from the data is that it's these mid-sized firms that exponentially change that ratio, right? Provide employment, add use capital. Those are the firms. And so that's one of the reasons why we're now focused on that. And of course, on the flip side, we also work with our students. We've stood up a minor in entrepreneurship at Morehouse and really work with our students to understand if they are not entrepreneurs when they leave and graduate, at least they have the fundamentals and what it means to be an entrepreneur later on in their careers.
I understand. This is In Black America. We'll be back with more of our conversation in a moment.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
If you're just joining us, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr., and you're listening to In Black America from KUT Radio. And we're speaking with Dr. Tiffany Bussey, the founding director of the Morehouse College Innovation and Entrepreneurship Center. Dr. Bussey, what is your definition of a small business?
For me, a small business is one that has a particular product or service in mind already. And I will also offer the definition a little bit different as comparing it to a startup. So a startup is one that has an idea, has what we call in academic language a hypothesis. I think this is something I should offer. And they're searching for that business model, searching to find out, is this indeed the product that needs to be there? A small business, however, has already found that. They have that product. I am selling 10 widgets, or I'm selling caps, I'm selling shirts. They have that, and they have opened their business, and they're selling that product. Really driving revenue. They have a set business model. They have a revenue structure that they are going at, and they're no longer searching. They may iterate, but they are very much set. So you would see those small businesses open for business, whether it is, and again, the definition in terms of size varies so widely. And John, I will tell you that perhaps it is that wide definition of a small business that perhaps creates some of the issues that we have in even growing them. If you go to the SBA, the Small Business Administration definition of it, it could go anywhere in terms of revenue from 100,000 to well over 100 million in revenue, right? Depending on the classification and what it is that you're selling. So I like to say that it is not what you're selling or the number of revenues or the number of employees that defines a small business, but it is how they're doing it. What is the business model? Have they already found the business model that they are executing? That makes them a small business. If you're still searching, you're probably in a startup stage of a business. I hope that makes sense.
It does. Are individuals coming to you prior to starting a business and or they are already in business?
As I shared, when we first started, our programs were pretty much focused on startups. So those mm-hmm. were those that think they had an idea. I'm exploring this. I want to start this. In the early stages, I would say perhaps the first 10 years of the center's existence. Now, in the past 10 years, we are now fully focused on what we call a cohort model. So it is only at the time of application that we invite folks to engage with us. Very specific to the industry. What we have found, again, because we're intentionally focused on scaling these businesses, is that if we work with what we call opportunity partners, which are usually your large corporations, such as your IBMs, your large general contracting companies, such as Holder, or, you know, if we work directly with them to understand what it takes to grow a small business and have them a part of their supply chain, they're partnered with us and we bring companies in specifically that can meet those opportunities.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we confront the challenges of censorship and freedom of speech in America.
Our guest today is Robert Korn Revere, one of the nation's preeminent First Amendment attorneys. He's now chief counsel for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. We also take a deep dive into the growing crisis of homelessness in the United States. As cities across the nation ramp up crackdowns, we examine the harsh realities faced by the unhoused. We speak with John Raefling from Human Rights Watch about his recent report on houselessness and its impact on human rights. Stay with us. I'm Heidi Boghossian, New York City attorney and activist.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties. Americans have a love-hate relationship with freedom of speech. They love to protect their own free speech, and they hate to protect the free speech of those they disagree with. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was intended to protect freedom of speech and freedom of the press, yet throughout American history, governments at all levels have censored speech and tried to muzzle the press. The anti-censorship group PEN America, in a survey of the 2022-23 school year, found that, quote, freedom to read is under assault in the United States, particularly in public schools, curtailing students' freedom to explore words, ideas, and books, unquote. Authors whose books are targeted are most frequently female, people of color, and or LGBTQ plus individuals. According to the American Library Association, the number of titles targeted for censorship surged 65% in 2023 compared to 2022, reaching the highest levels it has ever documented. According to Deborah Caldwell Stone, director of the ALA's Office for Intellectual Freedom, quote, each demand to ban a book is a demand to deny each person's constitutionally protected right to choose and read books that raise important issues and lift up the voices of those who are often silenced, unquote. To help us assess freedom of speech in America today, we've invited one of the most prominent First Amendment lawyers in the United States. Robert Korn Revere is chief counsel for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, known as FIRE. He has practiced First Amendment law for 40 years. From 1989 to 94, Korn Revere served as legal advisor and later chief counsel to the chairman of the Federal Communications Commission. Korn Revere is a prominent writer, thinker, and advocate on free expression issues and is regularly listed as a leading First Amendment and media lawyer by various national publications. He co-authored the three-volume treatise, Modern Communications Law. And in 2021, Cambridge University published his book, The Mind of the Censor and the Eye of the Beholder, The First Amendment and the Censor's Dilemma, which explores how free expression became a part of America's identity. I reviewed The Mind of the Censor for the Los Angeles Review of Books and called it an entertaining, enlightening, and timely book. Robert Korn Revere, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Steve, it's a pleasure to be joining you and a thrill to be on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you. Let's start off broadly. What are the most significant threats to freedom of speech in the United States today? And looking into the mind of the censor, what motivates those in power to resort to censorship?
Well, thank you, Steve. I appreciate the plug for the book and talking about the mind of the censor. I think the mind of the censor goes a long way toward explaining what the biggest threats to freedom of speech are. I think the mindset manifests itself in a couple of different ways. One is for those who truly believe in their cause for suppressing speech, for whatever reason, their mindset is based on absolute certainty. The journalist H.O. Mencken said that moral crusaders' very cocksureness is their chief source of strength. And that absolute certainty that you're right is something that leads people to believe that they should be able to use the power of the state to suppress others. And the other mindset that goes on is the mindset of the typical politician. If they see some political advantage in restricting speech and they don't care that much or overly much about constitutional principles, that will lead to a threat as well. And we see that manifest itself in various efforts to restrict speech, whether it's the campaigns that you've mentioned in recent years to ban school books and library collections, or the rush that we're now seeing these days about restricting social media, whether it's by conservative politicians who think that social media companies are moderating out conservative voices, or others from other parts of the political spectrum that want to restrict social media in general because they think of it as a threat to the psychological well-being of young people, which is sort of a reflection of a modern-day moral panic in the same way that we've seen with all other media directed at youth over the years. So it comes from a variety of political directions and a variety of sources, but those are the main threats. And I'll add one last thing to that, too, and that is whether or not we can maintain among people in general a belief in the spirit of free expression. The important thing, and frankly the threat, is not just from legal challenges to freedom of speech, but to whether or not people generally believe in the value of freedom of speech.
Support for freedom of speech historically was associated with the political left. Is that still true?
It can be. I think, as I alluded to a minute ago, the threats to free speech can come from all sides of the political spectrum. And one of the reasons why, historically at least, protection for free speech was coded as a liberal issue is because of the eras that we went through when First Amendment law was developing. And Steve can speak to this as well. And that is, if you look at when the Supreme Court and lower courts were developing protections for free speech, they were in certain eras of, you know, combating the Red Scare, or, for example, in the 60s, the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. And so those who were prominent in those movements depended on the protections of free speech to promote their causes. And so protection in that area was considered to be sort of a liberal issue. But the First Amendment is neutral, and it protects speech of all kinds, including truly repellent speech, like the Nazi party who wanted to march in Skokie, Illinois in the 1970s. The ACLU, to its credit, defended the right to march, even though the message that was being delivered was one that was repugnant to the vast majority of Americans. But the development of the law through those eras made it be associated with liberal causes. But more recently, you see opposition by some on the left to the fact that free speech extends to all speech, including conservative speech, including to what some would call hate speech. And so the protection for free speech and the defense of free speech by some on the left is not as robust as it once was.
Bob, what about the influence of big tech and social media platforms? They've been accused of engaging in censorship. What's your reaction to that? And do they pose as much or more of a threat to free speech than the government does, as some people claim?
Well, the direct answer to your question is no, they do not present either the same magnitude or the same type of threat to free speech as governments do. It's understandable that some people would rankle at the idea that their speech is being moderated on social media platforms or other internet forums. But the fact is that to make the internet usable, companies apply their terms of service. They apply various community standards to make sure that their sites aren't overrun with the kind of speech they don't want in their community, or they don't want to annoy their other users with. And those are editorial decisions, as the Supreme Court recently affirmed in Moody versus NetChoice. Those decisions are ones that those platforms do make as a both business choice and an editorial matter. And those aren't the same kinds of restrictions that you see when governments restrict speech. When private companies do it, it's editing. When governments do it, it's censorship, because the First Amendment, as you know, prohibits government action to restrict speech and not those private choices. Some states have reacted to these media platforms making these kinds of choices, saying that they are discriminating against conservative voices. The states of Florida and Texas passed laws that were recently reviewed by the Supreme Court, trying to prevent conservative politicians from being deplatformed, or conservative news organizations, or from applying these moderation choices in what they called a viewpoint-based manner. The Supreme Court hasn't finally resolved that case. It has sent it back to the lower courts for decision, but it made clear that we're talking about different kinds of activities when private social media sites make choices about the kind of community they want to established with their community standards or their terms of service, versus when government is making these kinds of choices. And one way to illustrate the difference of magnitude in the kind of threat to free speech is to look at the power that big social media platforms have. And they do have power and can exert their moderation choices in unwise ways. But the bigger threat is if you have government making a one-size-fits-all solution that then forces those social media platforms to adhere to whatever the government standard happens to be, which may differ from state to state. One question I ask that people sometimes have difficulty answering, the people who are in support of some kind of government intervention to prevent these kinds of choices being unfair or so forth, is to say, which of these measures would you support if your worst political enemy was in charge of enforcing the rules? Would you trust government to make those choices under those circumstances?
Robert, in your book, you focus a great deal on Anthony Comstock. Tell us who he was, how he figures in the history of censorship in America, and why is he cited in Project 2025?
It's remarkable that Anthony Comstock is an obscure historical figure today. He is really the father of American censorship, or rather, he was the person who sort of developed moral crusading as a profession, then became one of its first, in the words of H.L. Mencken, one of its kept professors. Anthony Comstock came to prominence in the early 1870s, first as a vigilante moral crusader, and then later as sort of the chief vice cop in the United States. He lobbied for and was able to obtain passage of a federal obscenity law, which he could enforce personally because he was named as a special agent of the post office with enforcement powers. He was also the secretary of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, which the title alone tells you what that was about. But he had this job for 40 years And he became essentially the national arbiter between virtue and vice in America. He used this obscenity law, which extended very broadly, to cover everything from promotion of contraceptives or abortion to medical texts, because he thought that they taught women too much about their own bodies. He used it to suppress art and literature. There was really no limit to what he thought was immoral and therefore could be prescribed under the law. During his 40 years as a vice crusader, he claimed that he prosecuted and convicted enough people to fill a passenger train 60 cars in length with 60 passengers in each car and a 61st car half full. So over 3,600 people in the course of a lifetime. And he was able to get away with this because the Supreme Court and the lower courts had not yet set any kind of First Amendment limits on what could be prosecuted under an obscenity law. He largely became forgotten because both the culture and the law passed him by. And in the 20th century, the Supreme Court developed First Amendment jurisprudence that made his law essentially unenforceable. But we are seeing some resurgence in interest today of resurrecting parts of the Comstock Act and trying to enforce them. A judge in Texas has cited the Comstock Act as precedent for suppressing abortion medication. He has cited the same act in trying to uphold bans on drag shows. And so it's little surprise that you would see some in the political world pointing to that. You mentioned Project 2025, which has mentioned the Comstock Act, as ways of furthering this agenda to restrict the kinds of speech the Comstock Act targeted and to resurrecting it in the 21st century.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. This is Steve Rohde, and I'm joined by Heidi Boghossian. And today, we're talking about free speech in America with Robert Kornrevere, a prominent First Amendment lawyer. Bob, the Supreme Court currently has a 6-3 conservative supermajority that has overturned important precedents like Roe v. Wade. But is the court a threat to the future of free speech in the United States? And how is it dealing with free speech challenges?
I think the threat that many people ascribe to the court is a false one when it comes to freedom of speech. Largely, those who are worried about the Supreme Court's majority are worried about particular political applications. And you mentioned overturning Roe versus Wade, which obviously is a matter of concern. The court should not be in the business of taking away rights. Fortunately, in the area of freedom of speech, the court has not reflected some sort of partisan divide and reflected in a 6-3 split, but has taken a much more nonpartisan approach. And the court has largely been very protective of First Amendment rights. I'll give you an example from this past term, the case of National Rifle Association versus Volo, which many would think is a conservative-leaning decision because the court decided in favor of the National Rifle Association. But it's worth pointing out that the NRA in that case was represented by David Cole of the ACLU, because the First Amendment principle at issue in that case was one that really doesn't lean left or right, but one that simply limits what government can do to coerce people into being silent. In this case, the state of New York was trying to use its financial and banking and insurance regulations to lean on businesses not to do business with the NRA because of distaste by the state for the NRA's political message. Now, you can take whatever position you'd like about how you feel about the NRA's message, but I think we should be able to agree, as the court did, using the power of government and its regulatory apparatus to silence political speech is a real threat to the First Amendment. So the case, both in its defense and in what the court did, are an illustration of how these First Amendment issues are not ones that you simply put on a political scale and determine whether they are left-leaning or right-leaning, but rather they are issues of the nature of our government and whether or not it should be it should have the power to restrict speech, either through formal or informal means. The court's decision in NRA versus Velo was unanimous, and it was authored by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. And it was, again, really not a statement politically one way or the other. The court merely upheld and reaffirmed a 60-year-old precedent called Bantam Books versus Sullivan, where the state of Rhode Island had tried to use an informal means of censorship. It had adopted a commission for the morality of youth that would put out a list of books that it thought were unsuitable for young people. And then occasionally a police officer would visit local bookshops and ask, are you still selling titles on that list? The court looked at that, and even though the state was not actually putting people in jail or banning books, that informal pressure was sufficient to violate the First Amendment. It was reminiscent of the tactics being used by the state of New York in trying to tamp down the political views of the NRA. It's similar to a matter that another of the social media matters that came before the court in this past term, where a challenge was made to the Biden administration for trying to put pressure behind the scenes on social media companies and their moderation policies. Now, as I mentioned before, the real problem with social media companies and moderation is if you give the government control over the decisions that they make, and that can either be done formally, as the states of Florida and Texas attempted to do, or informally, as the Biden administration was accused of doing in this case. The case is called Murthy versus Missouri. Now, in the end, the court decided essentially not to take on the merits of the charges against the Biden administration by saying that the plaintiffs in that case had failed to show their personal stake in it. They had failed to show what is called standing to bring these challenges. But the concerns about this sort of backstage manipulation of speech are significant and were reaffirmed in the Volo case. So as I was saying earlier, the political balance, one way or the other, doesn't reflect the 6-3 split on the court in political terms. But when it comes to free speech matters, you see the court taking a much more, I think, principled and constitutionally sound approach.
Those cases involve the concerns that social media is spreading disinformation and misinformation. And why shouldn't federal government, state governments monitor such information, which can have dangerous impacts in the response to COVID and in other settings? But the Supreme Court in New York Times against Sullivan and other cases has talked about whether or not the First Amendment protects false speech. And I think that issue tugs at people who might otherwise believe in free speech. What's the court's analysis on keeping government out of monitoring false speech and disinformation?
Well, that comes back to the same question, ultimately, of who you trust to be the arbiter of truth. This is a question that goes back to the founding of the nation. I mean, if you look back to the Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798, for example, one of the things that the Sedition Act prohibited was false statements about the government. And while that never resulted in a court case, the judgment of history, and actually the judgment of the Thomas Jefferson administration right after those acts expired, was that those efforts to have the government be the arbiter of truth were plainly unconstitutional. And if you fast forward to today, where you have a much more expansive ability to address a global medium, certainly the threats of false information are still there and may be heightened in certain respects. But so are the threats of putting the government in charge of deciding what's false or what isn't, and having it be the authoritative final arbiter. That was part of the issue that came up in the Murthy case, where the question was whether or not the government could even speak to or threaten social media companies. And one of the things that came up during the oral argument before the court and is reflected in the decision is that there may be many legitimate reasons why the government might want to be in touch with social media companies, whether it's to warn of foreign interference with elections or COVID information, a variety of other reasons, and that restricting the ability to have that kind of input would be premature, at least, and unwise in other circumstances. But that it's certainly possible that pressure by the government can go too far. And so that question is still an open one. The court didn't decide the merits of that issue, but it did reaffirm that when government pressure on deciding what is the proper mix of political discourse out there, that ultimately the Constitution doesn't permit that kind of coercion.
Robert, if you don't mind sharing, what initially attracted you to this field of law?
Well, the easy answer is that I used to be a reporter when I was in college and wrote for newspapers and magazines a little bit as I was continuing graduate studies. But I guess the real answer to the question is that I hate bullies. And to me, there's no bigger bully than having a government entity, whether it's local government or the federal government, telling people what they can read or think or feel.
What is FIRES, the organization you're chief counsel for? What is FIRES' role in helping to defend freedom of expression? And how can listeners support that cause in their local communities and nationwide?
Well, Steve, thank you for that question. First, a little bit about FIRE as an organization. We are the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. That is actually a new name. We, up for the last 23 and a half years before expanding in our role, were the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, focused almost exclusively on free speech issues and due process issues on university campuses. But a year and a half ago, FIRE expanded its mission to include free speech in society in general. And we do that through a combination of legal strategies, both trying to persuade governments to make the right choices when we see indications that they are not, or litigation when it comes necessary. But our mission is really broader than that, because we see the law of free expression as really a floor. That's just the legal requirement. We're really more interested in reaching hearts and minds, something we call the culture of free expression. And that's one of the things that we find especially critical in these polarized times, when you have people on different sides of a political divide shouting at each other and not listening and at each other's throats. We think that a culture of free expression is one in which people are not so sure that they are right, the opposite of the mind of the censor. You're not completely convinced that the other side is evil or wrong, but you're willing to listen to the other view. And in fact, we encourage people to seek out people and views with which they disagree. You just might learn something. And so it is that culture of free expression that is really probably more important than just the law. The law is in pretty good shape, but we're going through a pretty rough patch when it comes to promoting that culture of free expression. For those who would like to learn more or who would like to contribute to that view of free expression and a culture of free expression, visit our website at www.thefire.org.
Thank you, Bob, so much for being with us, for expanding on these issues. I think our listeners learned a lot today. And thank you for what you do every day to defend freedom of expression.
Thank you so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
In a 6-3 decision along ideological lines, the court overturned lower court rulings that held it as cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to penalize people for sleeping outside if they have nowhere else to go. This ruling now allows localities the right to dismantle encampments of tents and cardboard coverings, even when there is no locally available housing or shelter. Human Rights Watch has condemned the ruling and released a comprehensive report titled, You Have to Move, The Cruel and Ineffective Criminalization of Unhoused People in Los Angeles. The report documents the experiences of persons living on the streets, in vehicles, in temporary shelters, and in parks as they struggle to survive. In Los Angeles alone, tens of thousands of people are living in the streets, with death rates among the unhoused population reaching alarming levels. Governor Gavin Newsom, a supporter of the court's decision, has urged all local jurisdictions in California to destroy unhoused encampments, and several cities in the state have already begun doing so. The lack of housing is obviously a national crisis, and this ruling raises the He's represented political and community activists targeted for their very activism, as well as homeless people prosecuted for crimes related to their status. And I'm proud to say that John is also a member of the National Lawyers Guild. John Raefling, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi. Thanks for having me.
John, can you give our audience a snapshot of the extent and demographics of the unhoused population in Los Angeles? I've heard generally that homelessness is on the rise among veterans, families, and the elderly.
So in Los Angeles, the latest point in time count, which are probably a pretty substantial underestimate, showed that in Los Angeles County, there's around 75,000 unhoused people, and of that, 46,000 living in the city itself, the city of Los Angeles, which is a huge number, given that Los Angeles is around 1% of the U.S. population. That's over 7% of the entire unhoused population for the whole country. I'm not sure that veteran houselessness is going up, but certainly among older people, among families, it has been going up. The latest point in time count showed that the increases have leveled off and even a slight drop, but the numbers are incredibly high. And one of the things that's significant about Los Angeles, as compared with, say, a lot of Northeast and other parts of the country, is that most, like 3/4 of unhoused people in Los Angeles are unsheltered, meaning they're living on the streets, in parks, in their cars, as opposed to in some kind of shelter. And I'll tell you the other really significant and awful statistic, statistic is the wrong word, but on average in Los Angeles County, 6 unhoused people are dying every day. And that's a dramatic increase from just 10 years ago. Deaths are frequent and really horrible.
John, I'm sure you know a fellow guild member, Carol Sobel, who's done some excellent work vis-a-vis the Skid Row situation years ago. How did that affect Skid Row? I can't remember the facts.
Carol has brought many lawsuits in support of people living on Skid Row over her long career. And, you know, and one of the things that Carol has always done is that she's always made sure that she's working directly with the community organizations and community representatives there on Skid Row, pursuing their priorities. And that's, I think, made her an incredibly effective lawyer. One of the main lawsuits that she brought, and this was almost 20 years ago, the Jones case, raised the legal theory that if there's no place for people to go, if there's no housing or shelter available to them, then it is cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment to ticket them or fine them or arrest them for merely being on the streets. And that case brought a compromise agreement that allowed unhoused people who had nowhere else to go at least to not be arrested or cited at night until the city produced a sufficient amount of housing, which they did not do. Unfortunately, recent developments at the Supreme Court have invalidated that ruling. Some of the other big cases that Carol Sobel has brought are around the taking and destruction of unhoused people's property by the sanitation department. And in the report that I wrote, we really talk a great deal about not just policing, arrests, and citations, but how criminalization is accomplished by the sanitation department, just taking people's stuff and throwing it away.
Yes, we've seen that in New York. It's devastating to watch. John, we here in New York often view California as a trailblazer in many areas, human rights areas, from supporting reproductive rights to criminal justice reform to their stringent privacy policies. So this was a surprise to us. In the past, how has California generally responded to the issue of unhoused persons in years leading up to this Supreme Court decision?
It's always been a mix, but underlying the mix has always been criminalization. And I wouldn't say necessarily that California is leading. This is something that's happening all across the country. Cities and counties and now even states have passed laws making it illegal to simply exist in public space, which criminalizes the status of being unhoused. And California has done that and has traditionally done that. In recent years, particularly in Los Angeles, there's been more of a move to emphasize housing and emphasize services, but for a variety of reasons, but never at the scale that's needed to address the problem. And even as there's been emphasis on housing and services and funding to go along with it, criminalization has continued. And again, criminalization should be understood as the arresting and citing people for crimes related to their poverty and their unhoused status, but also the destruction of property that really has in recent years become the main focus of criminalization in Los Angeles. Now, all to say, there has been, and many of the policymakers in Los Angeles and throughout California talk a lot about housing. Right now they talk a lot more about shelter, which is different from housing. Shelter is not permanent. Shelter does not meet the international human right to housing. And shelter ultimately doesn't solve the problem if there isn't permanent housing on the other end of it. But even with emphasizing shelter and putting some efforts into housing, the criminalization has always been consistently implemented.
I know in New York, the shelters throughout the city are largely viewed as the last place many seeking shelter would like to go to. There's a lot of violence. They're not safe. Is that similar to California's shelters?
In California, in Los Angeles specifically, there's a variety of different shelter options. Some of them are big dorm-like shelters where you're, you know, sitting in a cot in a room with dozens, if not hundreds, of other people. to more shelters that give some more privacy, to things like tiny homes, which are 8-foot by 8-foot sheds, to hotel rooms. All of them have their benefit for some people, but all of them have real drawbacks, like what you're describing. So some people simply can't live in a congregate setting like that. The shelters have rules. They have rules like curfews, like even the hotel rooms have curfews. They have open door where you're searched, or your room is searched. Often the living conditions are, there's habitability issues. And so many people do not want to go into the shelters at all, and for good reason. Sometimes the shelters separate them from their partners, make them have to give up their property or their pets. And ultimately, the shelters are not consistently providing a pathway to permanent housing. So people may go in and they're stuck in these very difficult living situations with no end in sight. There's nowhere to go. And so many, many people either don't want to go in at all because they see it as a dead end, or they get stuck and they stay there, or they leave and go back out to the streets. Now, for some people, just getting indoors is really essential and even life-saving, but for others, it's not. And for others, being in those situations is really quite difficult, and they don't want to go in to the shelters. Whereas if there's housing or something with a real promise of housing, almost no one would reject that.
Was there a tipping point in terms of California's severe crackdown in the absence of viable options to the unhoused? Did something happen that brought us this harsh ruling?
I think it was 2018. A lawsuit was brought, and the Ninth Circuit, which has jurisdiction over all the Western states, including California, issued a ruling that said, look, you can't criminalize, you can't ticket, cite, arrest a person for staying in public space, right, for being unhoused, if there's nowhere for them to go, as in if there's not another place where they can go sleep or stay, or if you don't have shelter to offer them. And that slowed down criminalization, right? It was not a comprehensive ruling that could end the criminalization, but it certainly slowed it down. It put some conditions on and made the cities and counties and even the state more, required them to emphasize, well, at least we have to provide something. There's been great resistance by even our liberal governor, Gavin Newsom. In fact, Gavin Newsom called on the Supreme Court to overturn this decision, as did many other city and county leaders throughout California. Well, back on June 28th, the Supreme Court issued their decision, and they said, nope, there's no limit. Cities and counties can criminalize as much as they want. But they said that the Eighth Amendment does not limit it. That was the legal theory that did limit criminalization. So immediately after, cities and counties started making moves to increase criminalization. Within hours of the decision, a city council member here in Los Angeles moved a motion to start reconsidering the laws in the city around criminalization. The mayor of San Francisco is moving ahead aggressively to sweep out and remove encampments. The governor then, within a couple of weeks of the decision, issued an executive order for all state agencies to sweep unhoused encampments wherever they had jurisdiction, and recommending or urging cities and counties to do the same. And since then, he said, we're going to withhold money from you if you don't. To her credit, the Los Angeles mayor says, no, we're not down with criminalization. Unfortunately, criminalization is still going on in Los Angeles. So it's really, now is the time for her to show that she actually means what she says and to stop the sweeps and to take assertive action to stop city council from changing the laws to make them worse. The laws were already not good. The laws already allowed criminalization in large parts of the city.
John, let's turn to the Human Rights Watch investigation that led to your report. How would you summarize the main findings of the study, and
do some of the findings have national applicability?
Yes, I mean, I would say that, all of the findings have national applicability. Los Angeles is a case study, and in many ways, maybe the most dramatic case, though some people in San Francisco would argue they are. The general facts, much are specific to Los Angeles, but generally, I think it applies across the country. So the main findings, first, is that houselessness is caused by a housing crisis, a huge housing crisis that we have across the country, but especially in cities like Los Angeles. Los Angeles has something like, we're short 500,000 affordable units for people with a low income, right? That means that we have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who, if not unhoused, are a paycheck away, a traffic accident, a medical bill, right? One misfortune away from being on the streets. Secondly, we found that there's a huge racial component to houselessness. Black people in Los Angeles make up less than 8% of the overall population, but around one third of the unhoused population. And the report gets into policies dating back 100 and more years, but going on through the present, that have contributed to and caused such a prevalence of houselessness in the Black community. Third, this is again broad strokes, but big finding is that criminalization has been the default policy. And again, both by police ticketing and arresting, but also by sanitation department destroying and throwing away people's property. And sadly, the services sector gets dragged into it and has been in Los Angeles, has been essentially forced to be a part of the sanitation sweeps. Homeless services, shelter providers, particularly prior to the Supreme Court decision, there was the service providers would be required to go out to the sweeps and give this veneer that, oh, we're housing and we're sheltering everybody, when in fact they're housing and sheltering a small percentage of the people who are getting swept. But it has provided cover for policymakers. Oh, we're not being cruel. We're getting people housed. When that's not really what's happening. A critical finding is that programs that house people and programs that keep people in their housing especially have actually been really effective and have been effective and have not been implemented at the scale needed. So there's been numerous housing first, which is a whole theory or approach to housing where get people indoors into permanent housing where they can stabilize their lives, and then we can work on their mental health conditions. Then we can work on recovery from substance abuse, from problematic substance abuse. But housing is the first step. And those programs, when done right and fully resourced, have been extremely effective right here in Los Angeles, throughout the country, and even around the world. The problem ultimately is, particularly because criminalization is an option, criminalization seems more immediate and easier because the goal, whether stated or not, of criminalization is to make people disappear, to make unhoused people go someplace else where we're not seeing them. And then the problem doesn't exist because we're not seeing it, when in fact, it doesn't solve anything. It just moves the problem somewhere else, makes it worse for the people who are on the receiving end of criminalization. It interferes with efforts to get people housed and get them services, and it detracts from the real solutions that work, particularly housing.
Well, as you were talking earlier about the crackdowns in LA, I was wondering, well, where are these individuals going to go? Do you have a sense of where they're relocating or escaping to?
So that's the question. One of the community advocates I talked to in Venice, which is a neighborhood that has had a lot of unhoused people over the years and very aggressive crackdowns in the past 2 years. And she was telling me that the people who were in these encampments on this one particular street that got cleared out, they're now scattered around. They're still there. They're in alleyways. They're in their vehicles. They're hiding in parks. So what happens is, rather than have the encampments, which, well, the encampments are very problematic, but they also do provide some community and protection for people, those get destroyed and people end up on their own and much more vulnerable, much less safe. But they've got to go somewhere. Some of them are getting into the hotels and shelters, and some of those eventually into housing. But a lot of them end up back on the streets or never get into shelter in the first place. And so they're wherever they can go, wherever they can go and not have the police called on them and not have, you know, the sanitation department taking their possessions.
I'm curious, do you see any sort of vigilantes attacking homeless people?
There very definitely have been instances of that. I've heard numerous reports, and in the course of my research, I interviewed a lot of people living in encampments and heard stories about, you know, housed people coming around with baseball bats. And, you know, it's really hard to get a sense of how prevalent that is, but it certainly is happening.
Yeah. John, if you were the housing czar for the United States, what would your plan be to adequately address and hopefully reverse this houselessness crisis?
I would say the first step is the federal government stopped building public housing back in the 50s and instead moved to a whole other system of incentivizing private developers to build housing. That came on more in the late 60s and 70s and into the 80s. And what we now have is, instead of one source that funded the development of housing and essentially paid for all of it, is affordable housing developers have this very arcane and very expensive system where they have to put together different pieces of financing. It's a really inefficient system that makes it very hard and very expensive to develop housing. So first step is, I would get the federal government, which has large resources, back in the business of simply financing development of housing, not just pieces of it, but all of it. There are ways to develop the housing more affordably than, I mean, in addition to that system, but ways to develop using public land, you know, having state and local government grant approvals, removing bureaucratic hurdles, which, you know, I mean, the mayor in Los Angeles has done some of that. Also, one of the critical things is keeping people from losing their housing in the first place. There have been studies and, you know, successful projects where a small cash infusion to an individual can help them avoid becoming unhoused. That would be a highly efficient way to stop the inflow. There are services and programs to get people out of houselessness, but they struggle to keep up with the number of people moving into houselessness. And I would promote the Housing First effort to really get people housing with services as needed, particularly for the most chronically unhoused people. Those programs have been incredibly successful when they've been implemented and resourced.
Yeah, that makes total sense. How can our listeners follow your really important work and also stay informed on this issue?
Sure. So my work can be found at the Human Rights Watch website, www.hrw.org. If you put houselessness or homelessness in, you'll find my work. I would say tune in on social media to Western Regional Advocacy Project. The acronym is RAP. They're putting out some great educational and organizational information about fighting criminalization.
John, all of us at Law and Disorder, thank you so much for your crucial work in human rights, houselessness, for being a guild member, and for being on Law and Disorder.
Well, I really appreciate you having me on. Thank you.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Ebony Spectrum and In Black America for this week.
There's concern about a racial wealth gap.
The racial wealth gap is stark.
The racial wealth gap is tremendous.
The gap between white and black America.
What is the racial wealth gap and why is everyone talking about it?
The racial wealth gap is a measure of wealth inequality between racial groups in the U.S. Here's a prime example. Black families make up 14% of the population, but own only 5% of American wealth, while white households make up 65% of the population, but control 80% of the wealth. The gap traces back to the 1863 Emancipation Proclamation, which led to freedom for almost 4 million Black Americans. By 1860, their labor accounted for 60% of U.S. exports, $200 million a year, but Black Americans received nothing, no land, no money. Without any money or land, how could newly free Black Americans create wealth? One way could have been the banking system. Alexander Hamilton, the father of American banking, said that banking is how wealth is created. But Black Americans were overwhelmingly excluded from using banks. So what happens when a community is barred from the mainstream banking system? They create their own.
Hey!
banks are supposed to close the racial wealth gap. So what happened? For almost 200 years, there have been three unique barriers that have kept Black America from generating the wealth the Black community intended: discriminatory lending, housing discrimination, and economic segregation. First, let's talk about discriminatory lending. Following the Civil War in the late 1800s, Black Americans had few freedoms or financial options due to legal segregation and Black codes. Black codes were laws that restricted the freedom and movement of Black people and forced them to work for low wages. If you were Black, a white bank would either bar you from entering, deny your loan, or charge you higher interest rates. These were common practices of discriminatory lending, and it created a need for financial services that Black-owned banks would aim to provide.
Black communities found ways to create mutual aid opportunities, credit unions, and cooperative efforts to make sure that as they were locked out from mainstream financial institutions, they had the systems in place to make sure that their financial needs were met.
In 1890, one of the earliest Black banks was operating in especially hostile territory, the Jim Crow South. Alabama's first Black-owned and Black-operated bank, the Alabama Penny Savings Bank, was founded by Reverend William Pettiford. Influenced by Booker T. Washington's principles of self-help and racial solidarity, the Alabama Penny Savings Bank lent money to churches and professionals in Birmingham when other banks wouldn't. And it did this during a time when the Alabama legislature was doing everything in its power to deny Black political and economic freedom. Pettiford partnered with powerful white bankers in Birmingham who helped with administrative and staff training. These partnerships were like cheat codes during a time when segregation laws made Black and white relations very difficult. In 1913, the Penny Savings Bank constructed a five-story building that housed not only the bank, but dozens of other Black businesses. The rent from those businesses provided funding and investment capital, something Black banks serving poor communities struggled to get. The Alabama Penny Savings Bank faced financial risks unique to Black banks. A lack of capital or money to invest put Black banks in a risky position. Not only did segregation laws shrink the number of potential customers, low-income customers made smaller deposits and more withdrawals. This meant, one, operation costs were higher, so Black bank owners invested more of their own money to keep the bank stable. And two, it restricted their revenue and lending capacity. Fewer loans meant smaller profits. Pettiford's partnerships with larger banks meant he had aid during difficult times, and the bank grew significantly under his guidance. Assets reached over $540,000 by 1913, equivalent to approximately $17.1 million today. By 1914, the Alabama Penny Savings Bank was the largest and strongest Black bank in the United States. But no one could be convinced to help the bank after his death. The bank failed just 1 year later, causing depositors to lose all their money. While the Alabama Penny Savings Bank provided an alternative to discriminatory lending, Jim Crow segregation made long-term economic advancement nearly impossible. The second barrier to building wealth, housing discrimination.
One significant driver to the racial wealth gap, as I mentioned before, is going to be homeownership. Homeownership is a significant driver of wealth, whereby every year of homeownership, homeowners gain about $14,000 in equity. Conversely, if you don't have access to homeownership, you don't have access to that type of equity and that cushion that you could get from having money saved from homeownership.
Housing discrimination allows banks to deny home loans to the Black community through a practice called redlining. Redlining was a government-sponsored practice of denying mortgages and other financial services to segregated Black and brown neighborhoods. It's called redlining because bankers literally drew red lines around undesirable communities. One Black household in a middle-class community was enough to make the federal government deny mortgage loans in that area. As a result, Black families turned to predatory lenders or were shut out from home ownership completely.
We just keep having to fight battles, but a lot of the things that have happened to Black folks in America were orchestrated and they were legal. That was systemic. I mean, it wasn't like it just happened that way. It was designed to be that way.
Black banks made it their mission to fight against these policies. Maggie L. Walker was America's first Black female bank founder. Not only